I think the right introduction is Dear Welfarers and Wayfarers, because we are all included under both denominations. We would all seek each other's welfare, and we would all seek to help one another on the way to our destined end. When I first undertook to speak on this subject, the highlights of archaeology, I wondered what course I should follow. You know, archaeology is a tremendously great and wide subject. Its association with the Bible, which brings us here together and this subject before us, is very close and very intimate. And I thought the best way to deal with it was to take one or two phases of archaeology and show their bearing upon Bible statements. First of all, though, what is archaeology? Most people have some definite idea about it, but many have very hazy ideas about it. First of all, how did the word come into being? Because that's one of the peculiarities of our longer words. There's generally something behind them that tells us what they mean. Archaeology, so the dictionary told me when I looked at it a day or two ago, is made up of antique and ology. There's some question perhaps about what is antique. In some aspects, the word varies very much in its meaning. Some of you, for example, might think I'm rather antique myself. Certainly, I was born 86 years ago, and that does give you some idea of being antique when you look around and see you younger people before me. In its use in the word archaeology, the antiqueness is much further taken back than it is in relation to me myself. They gave, in this particular dictionary that I looked at, the general idea, the emphasized idea, that it had to do largely with Egypt and Assyria and Babylon and the Jews. I'm not going to say anything about Babylon or Assyria or the Jews. I'm leaving that for Brother Mitchell tonight when he shows you on the screen some of the things that bear on the archaeology of those districts. I'm going to confine myself to archaeology as a general thing, then to take two illustrations of how archaeology helps us. First, as we endeavor to understand our Bibles more and more, and secondly, as having some bearing upon that old question, how we got our Bible, because both of those things come under the general phase of archaeology. In 1815, after the Battle of Waterloo, archaeology became a greater possibility than it ever had been before. Amongst the things which Napoleon before then had taken away after his campaign in Egypt was the Rosetta Stone. And it was the fact that as that stone had a proclamation in it in three different languages, one of which was the Greek language, which people know, that enabled the first real stages to be made in reading those very strange inscriptions that you find in various parts of the world. I'm not going to go into details again. I merely want that as the starting point of understanding archaeology. That was followed by a strange experience in what is sometimes put down as archaeology, but really was nothing of the sort. An Italian named Belzoni found he could get to Egypt, and he had ideas that in the tombs of Egypt he would find very much that might, not interesting himself in his mental side, but might pander to his ideas of acquisitiveness. He broke open Egyptian tombs, mainly with the idea of taking all the gold that he could find there. In a way, he was an archaeologist, so he showed the way to do certain things, but really, it was no archaeology at all. It was sheer plunder. In 1822, news came from Nineveh of a certain discovery that had been made by the Arabs. Digging for stones to build his house, he came across a sort of statue. It was going to be useful, he thought, but he wasn't allowed to use it. The Mohammedan priest of the district ordered it to be broken up. There were strange writings on it. It must come from the devil, of whom you heard this morning. That was all they could say about it, and the thing was destroyed. Now that points to a certain overruling providence, I think, in relation to archaeology. If this strange thing had happened 100 years before, when the Arab was absolutely supreme there, his only masters being the Turks, who were Mohammedans as he was, there's no doubt everything that they found would have been broken up. But the news reaching Europe, it raised the feelings of quite a number of people, both in France and in England. Men went out there, not entirely at first for the purpose of archaeology, but were driven from their first object to that of archaeology. Botter, a French savant, he went out there. He commenced his operations. He dug up many things, most interesting things, including, amongst others, the signs that the old people of that district used when they wrote. I might as well tell you, it was the cuneiform as we know it now. If you don't know what it's like, well, go to the British Museum and then you can see plenty of cuneiform inscriptions. He made copies of all that he could, and he published certain letters about them. I'm the fortunate possessor of the first edition of that book, or rather of an English translation of that book. There are almost as many illustrations as there are pages. The number of pages is 40 or 50, and there are 48 diagrams. But not one single diagram can have a title put, or could have a title put to it when it was issued. That was the beginnings, in a way, of the archaeology of Assyria. I don't know whether Brother Mitchell will show you anything upon this. I shan't go further except to say that what he discovered was the palace of Sargon, an Assyrian king who had so absolutely vanished from history that no one knew who he was. And all sorts of suggestions were made as to what that reference to Sargon meant in the 20th chapter of the prophecy by Isaiah. That's one of the triumphs, I think, of archaeology. It explained a biblical message that no one had understood. The principal suggestion was that Sargon must be a mistake for Sennacherib, because Sennacherib does come later, as you know, in the prophecy of Isaiah. Following Potter was Sir Henry Layard. He first went out there in 1839. In 1845, he went there for the purpose of discovering all that he could about the district. His finds were great. They were helpful. They were the basis of the Englishman's following of archaeological research in the district of Mesopotamia. One thing that he did dig out, or rather his helpers dug out, was a statue. One of his helpers, one of his foremen, came running to him and said, "We found Nimrod himself." Of course, it wasn't Nimrod himself. The city didn't go back as far as Nimrod by any means. But that was the sort of impression made upon the Arabs who were helping in the work. Before then, another archaeologist of a different kind made some investigations. An American named Robinson went to Palestine to try and identify the various sites of places there, trying to harmonize the modern name with the biblical name. And he was remarkably successful up to a point. Then you come to 1865, when a very important incident took place in archaeology, the foundation of the Palestine Exploration Fund, a remarkable organization which even today is carrying out its investigations on the site of ancient Jericho. Later names you'll probably all be familiar with. They include such as Crowfoot, Woolley, Garstang, and many others. Those, all of them, great men in the archaeological world. And I notice on the cover of the Christabel film, which I received just before I came here yesterday, no, I actually on Thursday, the advertisement of a book by Woolley, where in 250 pages he describes one series, or one place only, where his investigations have been taking place, Ur of the Chaldees. And that furnishes the keynote to what I want to say now, and which explains why, just now, the 12th chapter of Genesis was read. I'm going to talk about the life of Abraham as it is given in the Bible, and as it is illustrated by archaeology. And I may say in passing that I don't know of any one particular character to whom archaeology offers such evidence. You know, when I was young, there were still people who said that there never had been a man named Abraham. It was a solar myth. That was the extremes to which men went in those days. No one ever says that sort of thing now. Abraham lived somewhere about the year 2000 BC. That was the time of the third dynasty of the city of Ur, which you will recollect was his city, according to the latest calculations of Woolley. In addition to being a solar myth, or rather in an alternative to it, Abraham, we were told, was a wandering Bedouin who had certain ideas, who found certain ideas, which started on the idea of the one great God. Now, no one who has read, and even less who has studied archaeology, would venture to say anything like that. And I hope in what I've got to say about Abraham and archaeology, I can show you how the evidence, whether it's direct or indirect, which archaeology throws upon Abraham himself and the biblical record of him, proves not only that the old theories were entirely wrong, but the Bible was absolutely right. Abraham is first introduced to our notice in the 11th chapter of the book of Genesis. He's introduced in a way that I think sometimes we rather tend to overlook, or we don't appreciate just what it says. We're told constantly that his place of origin was Ur of the Chaldees. You read that both in the Old Testament and in the New. And unfortunately, our authorized version makes one slight error in translation in relation to the early days of Abraham. I'll mention that in a moment or two after I've called your attention to the 28th and 31st verses. Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity, in Ur of the Chaldees. And Terah took Abraham his son, and Lot the son of Haran his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. Did you notice that particular word? Terah took Abraham. We get the idea, as a rule, that Abraham must have been the prime mover in that removal. But there, distinctly it says that Terah took Abraham and the rest out of Ur of the Chaldees. Now that tells you two or three things. It tells you, first, that Abraham was not a nomadic Bedouin. He was a citizen. He was born in Ur of the Chaldees, which was a great city, a royal city that had reigned over the surrounding country. Why did Terah take Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees? Did the divine call stand by itself, or were there circumstances which led to the divine call, or caused the call to come afterwards. We can't say. There's a matter I shall refer to a little later on, which does give a suggestion why Terah left Ur of the Chaldees. According to the history of Ur of the Chaldees, the city was dreadfully treated at one time, horribly. Here is an extract from the poem of someone deploring the fate of Ur of the Chaldees. When the Elamites overthrew, when order they destroyed, then like a deluge they consumed things together. Whereunto, O Suman, did they change thee? The sacred dynasty from the temple they exiled. They demolished the city. They demolished the temple. They seized the rulership of the land by the command of Enlil, that's one of the gods of the country, or the order was destroyed by the storm spirit of Enlil hastening over the land. It was snatched away. Enlil turned his eyes toward a strange land, the divine Ibu Sin. I'll ask you to note that word for a moment. Was carried to Elam. And these are Woolley's comments on it. There was no poetic exaggeration in his lament. There is not a single building of the third dynasty but bears the marks of violent overthrow. Ur must have been pretty thoroughly destroyed. Did that have some connection, as it were, with the movements of Terah and the call of Abraham? Had God moved Terah to get out of that place so that he and Abraham should not be destroyed? You cannot say, I cannot say, the archaeologists cannot say. But there's a strange connection of events. Abraham, born in Ur of the Chaldees. The Elamites thoroughly destroying the city right down to the ground. And before the city was destroyed, the call, at least to Abraham, maybe to Terah, but I don't think so, for matters that I'll mention presently, was left. The Elamites could do what they could. Abraham, the father of the faithful, the man to whom those fundamental promises that lead to the kingdom of God was made, he was sent out of Ur of the Chaldees, and they journeyed, the whole family, from there to Canaan, to Haran. 1,000 miles, roughly speaking, north of Ur to reach Haran. If you look at the story carefully and critically, the idea you will gather about Abraham leaving Ur was that he had nothing to take with him. There's not a mention of possessions of any kind in their removal from Ur. But when they got to Haran, Terah refused to go any further. He's still taking the lead even there. Perhaps in that you have to remember the strong influence of a parent on children in those early days. A map will show you that Haran stands right in the extreme north of Syria. It's just by the spot where two main roads met, even in those early days. The great north-south road that led from Asia Minor and eastern lands down to Egypt, and the east-west road that crossed the Jordan. And from all that is known of it, it was evidently a great place of trade. You are not surprised, therefore, when you read about their leaving Haran that they had great store of goods which they had gotten, and the souls which they had gotten. It was, as it were, the beginning of a turning point in the family's history. From having to flee from Ur, presumably with nothing or very little, they had the time in Haran where they were able to gain things, whether it was by trading, by working, we don't know, but there is that remarkable difference. Nothing from Ur, great substance, when they left Haran. And Haran was, as I said, on two great trade routes, just where trading might well take place. Well, now I'm going through this life of Abraham, and I want to call your attention, first of all, to the 12th chapter and the first verse, where the Revised Version makes a slight difference, but an important difference, in the wording. Now the Lord, not had said, now the Lord said to Abraham, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. It may be then that the call really came in Haran. I'm not sure. I won't put any emphasis on it, but it may be so in view of the Revised Version rendering of that first verse. Now, in the second verse, I will make of thee a great nation, I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. In the seventh verse, you read of Abraham being in the land at the place of Shechem, and then you come to the 13th chapter, or rather, till I go back. In the end of the 12th chapter, you read of Abraham's journey down into Egypt to seek substance when there was a famine in the land of Canaan. On some of the wall frescoes of Egypt, you can see similar scenes depicted. Arab sheikhs, Syrian people, going to Egypt, presumably to find support in time of famine. It's only a sidelight of archaeology. It doesn't tell us anything more than we know, but it's interesting to see that it does agree with it. And then at the end, towards the end of the chapter, we are told, 16th verse, Pharaoh entreated Abram well for her sake, as is for Sarah, and he had sheep and oxen, and he asses, and men servants, and maid servants, and she asses, and camels. The goods and the souls that they had gotten in Haran were greatly increased by the result, as the result of the visit to Egypt. And then you get a strange statement which needs to be looked at for a time. In the 13th chapter, verses 1 and 2, and Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the South, however, Authorized Version reads. It should be the Negeb or the Negeb. There's some doubt about the true pronunciation. And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver and in gold. Now we've been made more or less familiar with the Negev in these late days. It's a part of the territory handed over to the people of Israel who've gone back to Palestine. And from all that you read of it, it's a drear, sandy waste. it looks as if nothing could possibly be stayed there, and food and water found for a great company of people in a way, but still more for the great company of cattle that had. Abram was very rich in cattle, and yet he moved that cattle over the Negev to get to the land of Palestine. I'm going to read you an extract from the Biblical Archaeologist, a very useful little pamphlet which unfortunately is published in America and not in England, so we don't get it on our bookstalls or anything of that kind. No longer can one accept George Adam Smith's agreement with Robinson that no great route now leads or ever has led through the desert, through the district. Nor will it be possible any longer to accept Smith's dictum. Practically, the Holy Land extended from Dan to Beersheba, where, during the greater part of history, the means of settled cultivation come to an end. That is, they come to an end at Beersheba. How did Abraham manage to take his flocks and herds, his cattle and his asses across the Negev? Excavations are being carried out at the present time by American organizations which have found the ruins of many ancient cities all through the place. There is archaeology's answer to the statement by George Adam Smith, the great geographer in relation to the Holy Land, that no one could ever have lived and traded and journeyed about in the lands of the Negev. Since those days there have been Roman settlements there. That is another of the side lights, not the highlight, that archaeology has bearing upon our Bible history. Now you come to the 14th chapter of Genesis. My mind goes back to my early reading when I first began to get interested in this subject of archaeology. One great authority said, the whole chapter is absolutely unhistorical. There never was an Elamite supremacy in the country. Well, you heard the extract which I read of an Assyrian poet writing about those Elamites. And you noted, no doubt, the comment of Woolley that there was no exaggeration at all about the Elamite supremacy and the desolation of the land. What then? The great point of objection to the Bible story in the 14th of Genesis has the whole foundation knocked away from it. There was an Elamite supremacy in the land. And it's thoroughly well known now that following that supremacy, the supremacy went to Babylon, one of whose kings was Hammurabi, who may or may not be, opinions differ, although men like Albright, the great American archaeologist, states that the association is correct. I don't suppose most of us take much trouble when we read that 14th chapter of Genesis to follow exactly what it implies. Most of our Bibles give as the heading to the chapter the battle of the four kings against five. That is, the five who were in Hammurabi and Kedar Omer's group, and the four kings associated with Sodom. That's all they saw in it. Of course, in the olden days, they were not troubled very much about the details that led up to it. But if you read through the 14th chapter of Genesis at your leisure, you'll find that there is a real story, a real expedition. They went first of all, as the story tells us, 14th chapter, 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him, and they smote the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Caraphaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Sheva Kiriathaim, the Horites in Mount Seir, unto El Paran in the wilderness. Now if you look at your leisure, at your maps in your Bibles, you'll see that all those places were on the east side of the Jordan and the Dead Sea, the Arabah. Sodom, or the Vale of Sidon, and the one place that is mentioned, the last place that is mentioned, Engedi. That can be proved, I won't stop to give you the evidence. So you see those kings, Chedorlaomer and his gang, they moved all the way from southern Mesopotamia, right up the Euphrates Valley to the north. Then they'd come down on the eastern side of the Jordan, smiting these various districts, right the way down to the wilderness south of the Dead Sea. Then they turned and they came to En-Gedi before they reached Sodom and Gomorrah to fight the kings of that city. It was a gigantic expedition. The last thing that they did was they are fighting against the kings on the west side of the Dead Sea. I'm not going to say whether it was the south of the Dead Sea or the north. Archaeologists differ. English archaeologists mostly think Sodom was in the north. Americans think it was in the south. So I won't attempt to, not being a real archaeologist, but only a professing one, shall we say, I won't attempt to answer. But that tremendous expedition took place before things came to the crisis with Sodom and Gomorrah and the capture of Lot. The chapter is written because Lot was captured, and because Abraham rescued his son Lot, and because of that wonderful incident that took place with Melchizedek, the priest of Salem. But no one can say today, as many of our critics were saying 50 years ago, there's no basis for the 14th chapter of Genesis. It's all, well, bunkum, shall we say. There's real history behind it, and there's an insight into what really did take place, and we've only got it recorded because Abraham was concerned in it. And that's the case with so much in our theological knowledge. There's much revealed to us that explain things in the Bible and tell us things that are not recorded in the Bible. And it is by that combination that we're able to reconstruct the history of the past. Then we come to the 15th chapter and the reference to Abram's heir. This Eliezer of Damascus, as the authorized version puts it. Why was Eliezer of Damascus the heir of Abraham? It was Abraham who said it, you know. He said, I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus. Tablets which have been discovered in Mesopotamia show that if a man was childless, he could adopt someone, as Abraham had adopted Eliezer of Damascus. But they point out further that if afterwards the owner of the slave begets a son of his own, the slave has no further interest in the goods of the house. They go to the new heir. And other tablets explain later on between Ishmael and Isaac that if a wife gives a maid to her husband to get children by her, and she herself afterwards begets as a child of her own, the first child is deposed from his position. It's the exact position of the Bible story, with this exception that the tablets say the slave woman who has born the child must not be sent away from the home of her mistress. And you remember Sarah did make that demand of Abraham. And again, perhaps we don't always quite notice the facts of the case. Abraham didn't agree to Sarah's demand until he had taken the case to the Lord himself. He could order what he liked. God could conform with Sarah's ideas, and Hagar was sent away from the home of Abraham. I must pass over one or two things and now take you to the end of the life of Sarah, because it's a point I want particularly to call your attention to. You remember the incident how Sarah died, and Abram wanted some place where he could bury his dead wife. He didn't possess any land in the country of his own. He must have a burying place. So he sought the association of certain Hittites. They're called the sons of Heth in the record. Heth is H something T, and the Hittites are the H something T, because T and TH are the same in the Hebrew language, so you needn't worry about Heth and Hittites. He sought for them to find a place where he could bury his dead. They quite agreed. Well, he said, get me the cave that is in the end of the field of Ephron the Hittite. They take the matter to Ephron the Hittite. I'm summarizing it quickly because of time. And Ephron doesn't say anything according to the record that we have. He probably only said what he wanted to say to his Hittite colleagues. Yes, I'll sell Abraham the field and the cave, but I won't sell the cave only. It isn't put in those words, but that's what you read into it. Why did Ephron the Hittite take that attitude? Why did he make Abraham buy a whole field and all the trees that were in it, as the record tells you, when all Abraham wanted was the cave at the end of the field? Here are two Hittite laws that will explain it. If in a village anyone holds fields under socage, if you don't know that word, it's an old English word which, well, you find the idea in the feudal days, when a man owed certain duties to his lord or to the king. If in a village anyone holds fields under socage as inheritance, if the fields have all been given to him, he shall render the services. If the fields have been given him in only a small part, he shall not render the services. They shall render them from his father's house. If he usurps fields of the estate leaver, the people of the village give him a field, he shall render the service. You notice the point. Ephron was under legal power that he had to do something so long as he held the field. If he could only get rid of it, persuade this foreigner to buy the field, well, then he was free of the duties that had been placed upon him. That's another of the little sidelights instead of highlights which the archaeology throws upon Bible narratives. Well, I must leave Abraham here and deal with another point that I want to deal with, because it's more up to date in one way than the other. Amongst the many things of our antique that we like to get hold of, if we possibly can, are the original manuscripts, if it were possible, of the Bible. We can't do it, but we can get sometime near it. When an authorized Bible was translated in the year 1611, in the reign of James the First, very few manuscripts were known, and what they had got were Greek and very few Hebrew, mostly Greek, and various connected peoples like Syrians. That none of them went back to anything like the early times of the Bible, and it was not until a few years after the translation had been made that the oldest copy, as it proved to be at the time but not now, was discovered. The Alexandrian manuscript was presented by the Patriarch of Alexandria, who was transferred to Constantinople. He made it to King James the First. It didn't reach this country until after James the First's death, that is, after the authorized version was made, and it was handed then to Charles the First. Scholars were horrified. There were little differences between that and the Bible which they had as the authorized version. They need not have been troubled. It proves, it stands to reason, that when a book has been copied by hand hundreds of times over thousands of years, little discrepancies are likely to crop in. Sir Frederick Kenyon, who has given this subject more attention than almost anyone else that I've heard of, assures us that none of the alterations affect any particular doctrine that the Bible teaches or any particular passage of the Bible. The one that did make a mistake came from a Latin manuscript. That's the one about the three who bore witness in heaven. After the Alexandrian, another great manuscript was discovered. Its origin, nobody really knows. It was found by Napoleon when he took over the library of the Pope when he carried out his campaigns in Italy. Unfortunately, the Allies made Napoleon, or the French people, return it to the Vatican, and there it remained for years. All scholars knew it was there, but they couldn't look at it. Roman Catholic editions of it were issued in 1857 and 59, but they differed so much the one from the other that they were seen to be of use with. It came into use in 1868 and 81, and in 1889 a photographic edition was published. Then you have Tischendorf, seeking for manuscripts in Syria. He visited a library in the Sinai Peninsula, and in 1844, his first visit, he found some very old-looking manuscripts, paper as parchment, in the waste paper basket. He made it too clear that he was interested in them. He begged for them, and he got them. There were a number of leaves from what he thought and what up till recently proved to be the oldest manuscript that ever had existed in modern, that had existed in modern times of the Bible. He wanted to get more. He visited again in 1853. But it was not till 1859, when he went with the authority of the Tsar of Russia, that he was able to get hold of them. In quite a strange way, he had taken a copy of the Septuagint version with him, and he showed it to the steward. And the steward said, "Oh, I have something like that." He went and fetched it. They were the very leaves that Tischendorf had failed to get on his first visit. I suppose we shouldn't call Tischendorf an archaeologist. He was a collector of manuscripts, but he wanted them to be as antique as possible. And so we include in our survey of the highlights of archaeology. And now, what about modern times? I might just say, I suppose you all really know, that this Sinaitic manuscript is now in the possession of the British Museum. When the Tsarist regime was overthrown, the Reds had no use for old Bible manuscripts. Money was what they wanted. They tried an American syndicate first, but they didn't come to terms with them. And finally, the British Museum, with the help of the government and public subscriptions, bought it for £100,000. And now, just very, very briefly, to sum up afterwards. The Alexandrian, the Vatican, and the Sinaitic have now taken a back seat so far as history is concerned. Right back in the 18th century, the first find of papyrus was made in Egypt. Only one of the documents has survived. In 1877, many were found, some of them in most strange places. Probably you've most seen the mummies in the British Museum. And you see in the cases in which the mummies were kept. Most of those cases were made of papyrus. And Sir Flinders Petrie, amongst others, has had the patience, for it required any amount of patience, to separate one papyrus from another that formed these cases for mummies. Later still, a search was made at a place called Oxyrhynchus, a place in Egypt where it was known there used to be religious foundations, and quite a lot of them found there, hundreds, thousands of them. Some of you may have seen the sayings of Jesus, the logia of Jesus, certain sayings that Jesus said which are there. Now, amongst the things they've got are letters, accounts, bills, sayings, census papers, and Bible scraps. I'm going to tell you about one presently. Strange discovery was made. I'm going to illustrate that as best I can in this way. Here is a pamphlet. You can call it, as it was, in what I'm going to tell you, the Gospel of John. That page, or the cover, had been taken off. All the inside had been lost. There were two leaves like that, both of them damaged, but those two leaves had writing upon them, which experts said went back to the second century of the Christian era. And those two leaves contained the verses John 1:23-31 and John 20:17-19-25. You see what it meant? The first chapter of John was on that page. All the rest of John was here, and the finality of John was there. It was two leaves joined together of a second century edition of the Gospel of John. And again, when I was a young man, the critics used to tell us that the New Testament was largely the production of the second century. But here are two scraps containing verses from John found in Egypt. And John wrote his gospel apparently in Ephesus. The gospel that extended from the extreme west of Asia Minor, right through the whole of that country, down through Syria, Palestine, across the desert, and to Egypt. And a written copy existed in Egypt in the first half, or about the middle at the latest, of the second century. Those are the sort of things that archaeology is from time to time discovering. There's another one in the Ryerson Museum at Manchester. And now just a few words about the final phase of this. Perhaps you've heard of the Chester Beatty manuscripts. Chester Beatty was an American collector of manuscripts. He bought some in Alexandria. And they contain a tremendous lot of Old and New Testament records. They have been examined by Sir Frederick Kenyon, to whom I referred a little while ago. They have been read by him, studied by him, photographed for him, and they are published in a series of volumes. I've seen copies of the photographic edition. And there we have something that goes back to those early centuries, older than the oldest parchment manuscripts that we have, because they're on papyrus, which preceded the use of parchment. And then finally, just a few words. All of you are familiar with the expression, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The most marvelous discovery of modern times. I see my time is gone. I must put a very brief ending to it. A whole copy of the book of Isaiah has been recovered from those Dead Sea Scrolls. And it has this remarkable but welcome result that is found to practically agree with what is known as the real Hebrew manuscripts of the Bible, such as you might see in the British Museum again. The differences are small. The words generally agree. There is the good which archaeology has done for us in the matter of manuscripts. I was going to say more. This is all newspaper correspondence about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Books have been written about it. Numberless pages in the Biblical Archaeologist, in the American Bulletin of American Schools of Oriental Research. Over and over again it's referred to. So great is the importance attached to it. And the outcome of all archaeological research, the outcome of all this search for manuscripts is, as Frederick Kenyon, to quote him again, says, that you can trust your Bibles implicitly. A few thousand words through the whole lot may be questionable. All the rest is absolutely certain, if not as the original writers put it, but what they intended to convey. I think you'll see that one of the highlights of archaeology is to give us an implicit trust and confidence in the Word of God that we call the Bible.